Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here again to really get into a single topic using the material you sent us.
And today, it's quite a story. We're looking at episode 56, Vietnam's Longest Dogfight. 15 minutes that changed everything.
Right from the Military Tales channel on YouTube, it's a firsthand account from Colonel John Joseph Mulligan, Hoss Mulligan.
Yeah, absolutely gripping stuff.
So our goal here, our sort of mission for this deep dive, is to walk through what happened on that mission. May 20th, 1967.
Understand the insane odds he faced in the air, and then what came after, the POW experience.
It's quite a journey to unpack.
It really is. And the mission itself, I mean the scale of it. May 20th, 1967, the target was the Kiep Railroad Yards northeast of Hanoi.
Not just any target then, a key supply route.
Exactly. A choke point, really, for supplies coming in from China. Colonel Mulligan mentioned something like 100 aircraft were part of the whole operation that day.
Wow, 100 planes. And Mulligan himself, he was flying an F-4 Phantom.
That's right, part of an 8-ship F-4 squadron. Their job was what they called mid-cap protection.
Mid-cap, so protecting the bombers.
Yeah, basically running interference against any MiGs trying to get at the F-105 Thunder Chiefs, the fighter bombers hitting the actual target.
Okay, and they needed fuel support for something like that, I assume.
Oh, yeah. KC-135 tankers were up there, too. It was a complex operation.
So these F-4s, they're the screen. But things didn't go quite as planned, did they?
Not exactly. The flight ahead of Mulligan's, led by Major Phil Commies, they spotted MiGs, radioed back, said they saw them about 20 miles out. But Commies' flight decided to leave them. For Mulligan's flight, the second wave coming in.
Okay, so Mulligan's flight goes in, expecting MiGs 20 miles out. High alert. But
they get there, scan the radar, nothing. Mulligan talks about just staring at his scope, trying to pick them up. Empty screen.
That must have been unsettling. Where were they?
Turns out they weren't 20 miles out. They were right there. It was basically an ambush. And to make it exponentially worse, right at that critical moment, Mulligan's radio cuts out in his F-4.
No radio in a dogfight. That's incredibly dangerous. You can't coordinate, can't warn your wingman.
Exactly. You're blind to what's behind you if your wingman can't tell you. And then he looks up from the scope.
And sees.
Not empty sky. MiGs everywhere. 32 MiG 17s.
32. Against how many F-4s in his immediate flight?
Well, initially four, but the source says two of them, Captain Bob Pardo's element, had to break off almost immediately to protect the F-105s from other MiGs.
So it's just two F-4s left, Mulligan and his lead, Robin Olds.
Just the two of them, facing 32 MiG 17s, and these weren't just scattered planes, they were organized.
How sucks.
Mulligan describes two circles, 16 MiGs at their altitude, around 14,000 feet, and another 16 stacked just below them, a deliberate trap.
Incredible odds. 8-1 initially, then 16-1 for those two jets.
And then there's the weaponry issue. The MiG 17s, they had cannons, 23-millimeter cannons.
Fast firing, good for close-in fighting.
Right. The F-4s at that time, primarily missiles, Sparrow radar-guided Sidewinder heat seekers.
Which need distance to work, right?
Exactly. Mulligan says they were basically useless under about 350 yards. And a dogfight like this, it gets very close, very fast. They were suddenly in a knife fight with planes designed for it while they were armed for longer range.
So what happened? How did it kick off?
Robin Olds, the lead, immediately went after two MiGs. But just as quickly, two more MiGs latched onto his tail, firing.
Putting Olds in immediate danger. And Mulligan's job as wingman
is to protect his leader. His aircraft commander, Major Jack Van Loan, asks Mulligan if he can get a missile lock on the guys chasing Olds.
But too close, presumably.
Way too close. So they do something incredibly risky. They fire a Sparrow missile, not at the MiGs, but across their noses.
Just trying to spook them, make them break off.
Pretty much. Just the sight of a missile coming off the rail might be enough. But then...
this is where it gets truly bizarre.
Go on. One of the MiGs fires a missile back a Russian ATOL, a heat seeker. But instead of locking onto the massive heat signature from the F-4's engines...
it locked onto.
The Sparrow missile they just fired. A heat-seeking missile went after another missile.
You're kidding. That sounds impossible.
Mulligan himself says the odds are almost incalculable. He still remembers seeing that missile chasing the other missile.
Unbelievable. Did that save them?
Only for a second. Almost instantly, two more MiGs were on their tail firing tracers. Red ones, 23 millimeter.
So back in the thick of it.
Immediately. Mulligan and Van Loan yank the plane into a hard 4G climbing turn. Super stressful maneuver trying to shake them.
Did it work?
It worked on the first two they stalled out below them. But that hard turn cost them airspeed. They slowed way down to like 250 knots. dangerously slow.
Making them vulnerable.
Exactly. And sure enough, two more MiGs dive on them from the 2 o'clock high position, firing yellow tracers this time, 37 millimeter cannons, bigger rounds.
Could they evade this time?
They turned into the attack, but the MiGs hit them. Mulligan felt it a thud, hit the main fuel tank right behind his seat, and then the controls just froze. For both pilots, they knew instantly the plane was gone.
Time to get out.
Had to eject. Mulligan said his last look around before pulling the handle, he saw two more MiGs firing at them from the 10 o'clock.
Just relentless. How long did this whole fight last?
15 minutes. 15 minutes of continuous, intense combat.
That feels like an eternity in a dogfight.
It's believed to be the longest dogfight in jet aviation history. That's what Mulligan states in the source.
And the result, despite those odds.
The U.S. forces, remarkably, shot down seven MiG-17s that day. And crucially, not a single F-105 bomber was lost to MiGs.
That's incredible mission success for the bombers.
Absolutely. But the cost was Mulligan's F-4, the only U.S. plane lost in that particular engagement.
And then ejection. He mentioned ejecting through a fireball.
Yeah, he punched out right through the flames of his burning jet, suffered really severe burns, third degree on his forearms, first and second on his face and neck.
Horrific.
Hey.
And the landing.
Came down hard on an 8,000-foot mountain, and in the shock, he forgot his parachute landing fall technique.
Oh, that's crucial. What happened?
Blew out his right knee completely, tore both the medial and lateral collateral ligaments. The source compares it to Joe Namath's famous knee injuries. Just completely shredded.
Burned, severely injured knee. And then?
Captured almost immediately by local tribespeople. And despite the agony of that knee, they forced him to start marching down the mountain.
Unbelievable cruelty. That's just the beginning of the ordeal, isn't it?
Yeah, the start of years as a prisoner of war and the conditions Mulligan describes. They're hard to even comprehend.
What does he say about the camps?
Just brutal. Years of torture, constant beatings, injuries like his burns and knee, plus diseases, just left untreated, barely enough food or water.
And living conditions.
Filthy cells, poor hygiene, rats everywhere. Sometimes the food they did get was deliberately contaminated. Plus the extremes of weather, freezing winters, boiling summers. Constant misery.
You must have seen terrible things happen to others, too.
He shares some absolutely harrowing stories in the episode. Red McDaniel, broken back, mangled leg and arm from torture.
Okay.
Bill Metzger had a massive shrapnel wound in his thigh, down to the bone, plus a broken femur. Never treated. Shrapnel in both arms, too. And they kept him naked for a whole year.
Naked for a year? How do you survive that?
It's hard to imagine. Then there was Tom Sterling. Broke both his femurs ejecting. He actually got surgery in Hanoi, but afterwards they only gave him milk for a month. Just milk.
Unbelievable. And Mulligan's own burns, how did he cope with those with no medical care?
This is just incredible resilience. His survival kit had nothing for burns. His arms got badly infected.
So what did he do?
He remembered something from survival school. He used maggots.
Maggots?
Yeah. To eat the dead, infected tissue. Then he rinsed the wounds with his own urine midstream. He specifies and bandaged them with strips he tore off his t-shirt. A Batman t-shirt, apparently.
That is astonishing resourcefulness in the most horrific circumstances. It mentions other injuries from torture, too.
Dislocated both shoulders, nerve damage in both elbows, bilateral neuropathy. And there's another story, Gary Anderson.
What happened to him?
Got hit with a rifle butt, ruptured his eardrum. It got infected. The pressure was agonizing. So he took a rusty nail and re-ruptured his own eardrum with it to let the pus out. Just desperate self-preservation.
It's almost impossible to fathom enduring that. Yet the survival rate was surprisingly high.
Around 90%, yeah. Mulligan attributes it to several things. First, an amazing underground communication network. The prison grapevine.
How did that work?
Various tapping codes, hidden notes, whispers, ways to share information, keep morale up, know who was alive.
Vital connection. What else?
Maintaining military structure. They had a chain of command, senior officers giving orders, maintaining discipline as best they could, orders of the day.
Keeping that sense of order.
Absolutely. And then faith and hope. Faith in God, faith in each other, faith in their country, and this core belief. The U.S. doesn't leave its people behind. They believed rescue would come.
That belief must have been a lifeline. He also mentions the Santa Fe raid.
You mean the Suntay raid.
Oh, yes, Suntay. My mistake. What was his perspective on that?
Right, the Suntay raid. He actually saw the firefight from his camp, Camp Faith, which was about 5 kilometers, 5 clicks away. Didn't know what it was at the time.
Just saw distant fighting.
Yeah. Later, after they were moved to the main prison, the Hanoi Hilton, they learned the details from Asian prisoners who'd been there.
Did the raid itself help them directly?
Not in freeing them from Sun Tay, as the prisoners had been moved, but indirectly, yes. It spooked the North Vietnamese. They consolidated many POWs into larger cells in the Hanoi Hilton afterwards.
Which actually helped the prisoners.
Immensely. Better communication, more mutual support, stronger internal organization. It was a big morale booster, even though it failed in its primary objective.
Then there's the almost unbelievable story of Doug Higdal.
Oh, yeah, the guy who fell overboard.
That's him, a Navy seaman, fell off his ship, trod water for hours.
10 hours, the source says, then captured and tortured, even though he knew basically nothing of military value.
They thought he was CIA or something.
Briefly, yeah. Seemed too clueless to be real, maybe. Eventually, they decided to release him early, use him for propaganda, see how lenient we are.
But he didn't just leave, did he?
No way. Another prisoner, Air Force Lieutenant Joe Cracker, had an idea. He taught Hegdahl to memorize names, hundreds of names of fellow POWs.
How on earth did he memorize hundreds of names?
Using a song. To the tune of Old MacDonald Had a Farm, he learned them alphabetically by last name, with rank, service branch, aircraft type, base, or carrier. E-I-E-I-O.
That's incredible ingenuity.
Isn't it? When Hegdahl was released, he brought that list out. It was the first concrete proof for many families that their loved ones were actually alive. Invaluable
What
intelligence.
a story. Did the overall treatment change much over the years?
Mulligan indicates it did. Initially, it was incredibly harsh. But things apparently eased up somewhat after Ho Chi Minh died.
Interesting.
And then, as we said, the Sun Tay raid, despite its tactical failure, led to that consolidation in Hanoi, which significantly improved morale and conditions in terms of prisoner interaction.
Before we wrap up, he mentioned a film, Return with Honor.
Yeah, he noted it won an Academy Award, but strangely didn't get much play in U.S. theaters. An accurate portrayal, from what he implies.
So looking back at this whole account from episode 56, it's just staggering.
It really is. Those 15 minutes in the air, the missile chasing missile moment, the sheer odds, and then the years of captivity.
The self-treatment with maggots, the communication network, Hegdahl's song. It's detail after detail of human endurance and ingenuity.
Absolutely. And that moment with Hegdahl getting out with the names, that aha moment, it's such a powerful reminder that hope and vital information can surface in the bleakest, most unexpected ways.
It definitely leaves you thinking. As you reflect on this, on Haas Mulligan's story, maybe ask yourself, what does facing this kind of extreme, prolonged adversity really show us about our capacity to survive? Not just physically survive, but to adapt, find community, and hold on to hope against seemingly impossible odds.
It certainly gives you a profound respect for the sacrifices made and the incredible strength of the human spirit, particularly for those captured in war.